2, and there's a lot to talk about with him, and we're not going to get to all of it, surprise, but we're going to get somewhere. That's the, So, Rabbi Yosef Albo, in certain ways, is the opposite of the philosopher we started this series with, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet. In the sense that Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, you will recall, was staunchly conservative, fighting off threats from within the Jewish community and externally. And Rabbi Albo liberalizes certain things within his approach to philosophy. I brought you here just as an interesting line in the sheet in source number 8. And this is from Yitzhak Baer's A History of the Jews in Christian Spain, Volume 2. You will recall I used Volume 1 when we were talking about Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet. There was a great debate between Jews and Christians in Tortosa in 1413. We're going to come back to that story. Rabbi Albo was one of the debaters. And he makes the comment that you see here in number 8, and it's Baer's translation. Assume that it will be proven to me that the Messiah has already appeared, I would not therefore think myself a bad Jew. In other words, even though, according to Maimonides and many others, it is a basic principle of faith in Judaism that a Messiah has not yet come but could come any day, he says, even if it were proved to me that the Messiah had already come, that wouldn't make me a bad Jew. In other words, not to believe in the Messiah is not heretical. Not heretical. So we're going to have to talk about this. We're going to have to talk about Rabbi Albo and his approach to heresy and to Judaism. But first, a little bit of biography. We don't... Yes, Ginny.
Is it not to believe in the Messiah or to believe the Messiah has come? That sounds like Christianity.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And yet he argues that that could fit.
Right.
Yeah. But not to believe in a future Messiah.
Right.
Yeah. No, not to believe in a future Messiah, I should say. But that's what Maimonides has in mind. So we don't know that much about his personal life. Very little. I did see somewhere, I think, that he had a couple of sons, but I'm not even sure where I saw that. We do know he's born in Aragon, that province where we know Nachmanides lived, where Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet lived, where Rabbeinu Nissim lived for at least part of his life. So he's born in Aragon, northern Spain, right by the French border, approximately 1380. He was a student of a philosopher named Rabbi Chasdai Kreshkish, who I really should have brought in this series. If we had another week, I would have totally done that. My favorite piece from Rabbi Kreshkish still is, I think I mentioned it at some point, where he says, yeah, there could be life on other planets, intelligent life on other planets. He has this whole discussion about it. So at some point we should really study him. But he was a student, Rabbi Joseph Albo was a student of Rabbi Kreshkish, who was a heavy influence on his philosophy. Rabbi Kreshkish was himself a student of Rabbeinu Nissim. So we have the chain. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet influences Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim influences Rabbi Yosef Albo. We know that he learned Spanish as well as Latin, which came in handy in his debates with the Christians. He was very interested in the natural sciences. Take a look at source number 9. I love this. He's talking about, it's a side note, it's a throwaway comment in his introduction to his major work, the Sefer HaIkarim, in Hebrew, the Book of Principles, as it's translated here. He's talking about how God's handiwork is ideal, as he sort of prays in the introduction for God to make his handiwork ideal. And in it, he just throws in this line, which I translated for you here. He says, even though it is not the way of the bee, according to the nature of its material, for it to possess comprehension to build such houses of wax with honey stored in it in hexagonal forms. He says, you know, bees as creatures shouldn't be smart enough to design honeycombs. But he says, its creator, the greatest creator, placed in it comprehension to build them in that form. Nonetheless, they know how to do it. It resembles the circular form, which is the natural form, right? In nature, things tend to be circles. But it has an added benefit. Hexagons are better. In hexagonal forms, the entire area and open space is filled with forms that are beside each other without any open space between them. As opposed to a circle, if they would make circular structures beside each other, a great space would remain between them from which they could not benefit. You follow? Right? When you look at a honeycomb, all the hexagons are aligned like that, and there's no space that is unused. He says, in nature, we don't find angles like that. In nature, we usually find circles. And if you're finding hexagons, it's because God decided that it would be good for bees to be able to do it, and God inspired it in them. Just that observation that he's making, I find very interesting. He was of that mindset. I actually saw someone who wrote that he might have been a doctor. He does write a lot about medicine. I don't know that he was a doctor. But as I said, he's born in Aragon approximately the year 1380. Major event of his early life happened in 1391. In 1391, there was a harsh pogrom instigated by a church official by the name of Ferrand Martinez. And it spread throughout large parts of Christian Spain. So in the province of Aragon, in Castilla, in Seville, all of those areas, thousands and thousands of Jews are killed. I saw one place that said estimated 50,000, which seems very high, but you're talking thousands and thousands are murdered in this pogrom when he is approximately 11 years old. So that may have an impact, it should have an impact, on his thinking and his experience. The year 1414, so he is at this point in his early 30s. This is a mess. I'm going to skip the mess here. There's a whole historical period in which there were two popes. Right? There was a pope, and there was an anti-pope. That's what's going on at this stage. Benedict XIII was a nobleman and cardinal, and he was nominated to be pope by those who were opposed to the pope in Rome for reasons that are way too long and convoluted for our conversation, and honestly, I don't really understand them. So
I think he was from the Tuscan region.
So there's a whole thing about the Pope being in Avignon, and I don't want to go there. But Benedict XIII in that region is functioning as Pope. And he is the one who calls for this disputation between Jews and Christians on charges that the Talmud was an evil book. The debate was between a fellow who in English we write as Geronimo de Santa Fe, or Hieronymus. He was a Jew who had converted to Christianity. He was Benedict XIII's personal physician. A lot of Jews who were in medicine back in the day. His Jewish name before that was Joshua Lorki. So he was on the Christian side, along with a monk by the name of Vincent Ferrer. I've seen different ways of presenting his name, but that's a popular way to present it. And there were hundreds of church officials who were present. That's all on one side. On the other side, you had representatives of 20 Jewish communities. Rabbi Albo was among the youngest, represented a town called Daroca, D-A-R-O-C-A, which is a community in Aragon. The debate lasted 7 months, and it ended, not surprisingly, with each side claiming victory, you know, because that's always the way it works. In the year 1415, his community of Daroca was destroyed in a campaign to force conversion, alongside new decrees that Benedict issued of persecution in Aragon. Take a look at source number 10, please, where I brought you some of this. In the hope of mass conversions, Benedict issued on May 11, 1415, a bull consisting of 12 articles, which in the main corresponded with a decree issued by Catalina, which had been placed on the statutes of Aragon by Fernando. By this bull, Jews and neophytes were forbidden to study the Talmud, to read anti-Christian writings, in particular the work Masalem or Margesu, to pronounce the names of Yeshu, Maria, or the saints, to manufacture communion cups or other church vessels, or accept such as pledges, to build new synagogues, or to ornament old ones. Communities were only allowed to have one synagogue. That in and of itself is torture for Jews. Jews were denied all rights of self-jurisdiction, nor might they proceed against accusers, people who tried to turn them over to the Spanish government. They could hold no public office. They were not allowed to follow any handicrafts or act as brokers, matrimonial agents, physicians, apothecaries, or druggists. I don't actually know the difference between an apothecary or a druggist. I thought they were the same thing, but apparently they're not. They were forbidden to bake or sell matzah or to give them away. Neither might they dispose of meat, which they were prohibited from eating. They could not have any involvement with Christians. They may not disinherit their children if their children get baptized. They should wear the badge at all times. Thrice a year, all Jews over 12 of both sexes were required to listen to a Christian sermon on the Messiah. So this is the state of things in 1415, and at that point he leaves town. Rabbi Albo left and he went to the province of Castilla instead. His major work, as I said before, is the Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Principles. And his goal was to clarify the basics of Jewish belief, because he felt that those who had done it before him had created more confusion than clarity. Maimonides, before him, had come up with the 13 principles of faith, right, which we've seen codified as the Ani Mamins, although that's not his writing. Let me take that back. Let me leave aside the question of the Ani Mamins. But he writes 13 principles of faith. Others had written their own. Take a look at number 11, please, where Rabbi Albo says, I apologize for the noise behind me if it's distracting anyone, but they're between periods here in the school, so the hallways are full. The difficulty of knowing the principles of Judaism is because we have not found, among the many sages who spoke of principles of religions, one who spoke in a way that sufficed, or that they would agree regarding the principles or their number, meaning all those who wrote about the principles came up with their own lists. Instead, there is great variation among them, and especially regarding the essentials of the Torah of Moses. Even though all agree that it's divine, they vary regarding the number of its principles in no small way. Some say 13 principles, some say 26 principles, some say just 6 principles. So he says, there's a lot of confusion about what the basics of Judaism are. And the reason it matters is because, not just because, you know, you need to know what to do to be a Jew, and you need to know, like, sort of what's the essence, what are we supposed to believe, but because you're dealing with Christian polemics and disputations that are attacking the Jewish community of their day. So what he wants to do, and this is after the disputation, he finishes this in 1425, so it's after the disputation, what he's trying to do is reinforce the Jews against Christian polemics and Christian arguments. Here's what a Jew needs to believe, and he's lenient compared to the earlier lists. And that's a key point here. It's sort of not unlike the attempt of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in Muslim Spain in the 11th century, writing the Kuzari, trying also to answer what the Jews were hearing from Muslims at the time. So he's dealing with Christianity, and he mentions Christianity from time to time explicitly in the book. Like, he's clear about what he's doing. He also gives you, at one point, how you know a religion is truly divine. And this is clearly an anti-Christian polemic. Take a look at source number 12. He says, verification of Torah as divine is in two ways. You want to know how you know that Torah is from God? The religion itself, and of the agent who brought it, meaning Moses. Regarding the religion itself, the three principles we have recorded, which we're going to get to, must be tested with the roots that emerge from them as we wrote above. And if it does not contradict any of the principles or roots which emerge from them or depend on them, then it is divine. Number one, Torah has to be internally consistent. You can't have it demanding that you believe things that contradict other parts of the Torah. Number two, he says, otherwise he says it's a forgery, emulating the divine. If it contradicts itself, it's not from God. But second, he says, regarding the agent who teaches the religion, it is when the prophetic experience of the prophet is verified, for him to be the agent through which the Torah is given, with intrinsic proof as opposed to extrinsic proof. He wants there to be proof that this person is a prophet, based on this person's character, based on this person's identity, and he goes on with that. And his point is to say, Christianity doesn't have these. Judaism does. That's his purpose. So this work, which we're going to talk a little bit more about shortly, is considered a very important expression of Jewish philosophy of his time. It's one of the first works of Jewish philosophy that was printed on the printing press in 1485. He combines logical argument and deduction from scripture and from Talmud and from Medrash. He draws on Maimonides, he draws on Rabbi Chasdai Kreshkish, his mentor, he draws on his contemporary Rabbi Shimon Duran. Some see here also influence of Thomas Aquinas, the Christian writer, in a section where he talks about natural law. His writing is very direct. It's really a pleasure to read compared to other Jewish philosophy. And if anyone here has ever tried to read Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, but it's hard. He's got all sorts of jargon. Not so Rabbi Albo. Very direct, very simple in his writing, and that for sure contributes to its appeal. So the book has an opening section in which he talks about the whole concept of having principles of faith. And then he outlines three principles of faith with the roots that lead to them and come from them and their branches. If you look on your sheet in source number 13, the three principles that he has that a Jew has to believe in are God exists. Okay, no Judaism without a God. Torah is from God, and God rewards and punishes. Those are his three principles. Not necessarily reward and punishment in this world, but in general. Those are his three principles. As for their roots, well, from the saying that God exists, he also says you have to believe God is one. God has no physicality. God is outside of time. God lacks nothing. That's what it means to believe in God from a Jewish perspective, he says. Saying that Torah is from God requires a belief that God knows everything, that God communicates via prophecy, that's how we get the Torah, and that God's messenger is legitimate, God's agent is legitimate. And then, if you believe that God rewards and punishes, then that means there is something called divine providence, that God is actually running the show, whether that's on a more narrow level or a more broad level. Those are the things that he says a Jew has to believe. He then identifies branches from these that he says a Jew should believe. However, in the event that a person doesn't believe them, he's just wrong. He's not a heretic. And this is really where he breaks from Maimonides' list. He says, yes, you're supposed to believe God created the world out of nothing, not that there was some material before. But if you don't, that doesn't undermine Judaism. You should believe, Moses is the greatest prophet. Torah is eternal and unchanging. But again, if a person doesn't believe that, so they made a mistake. They're incorrect. Mitzvot, you should believe, bring a person to perfection. The dead will ultimately be resurrected. Chiyas HaMeisim. The Mashiach is going to come. And as I said to you before, from his line in that disputation, and if you don't believe it, you're still a Jew. You may be wrong. I mean, he believes that these things are true. But he says it doesn't drum a person out. You follow? He's really much more loose in what he is demanding of the Jews of his day. Now, there's some debate as to whether his philosophy was original or derived entirely from his predecessors. He also has some contradiction within his book, where he'll say one thing in one place and then seems to say something else in another place. Historically, it was assumed that that was because he was sloppy. Like, these are just mistakes. However, take a look at source number 15, which comes from his introduction to part 2 of the book. I think I started mentioning before, he has 4 parts to the book. Part 1 is where he presents what the principles are. Parts 2, 3, and 4, each of those is devoted to one of the principles. So part 2 deals with God being, God existing. So take a look at his introduction to part 2. He says, "What should not be overlooked by one who reads this book is this. Many things are stated in one place according to the view of the speaker and not according to actual truth. And they're stated as the opposite in another place, according to truth. Meaning, sometimes I'll say something quoting somebody else in order to disagree with it somewhere else. Or they will be stated in one place with one intention and another place with another intention, as Maimonides did in many places in the Guide of the Perplexed. And this is the approach of many polemics." So he tells you, this style is intentional. I'm doing this as a way to present different ideas, to present different perspectives. Others have argued he did it in order to confuse people about what his own opinion was. But that's an argument that's made. You follow? Okay. So I'm going to come back to more of his thought in a minute, but I just wanted to make sure to get through that, and then to say he dies in Castilia, approximately the year 1444, as I understand it. His impact is huge. This book, the Book of Principles, was translated into Latin, into German, into Italian, into English now, and into Russian. And it had tremendous impact on future philosophers and writers on Judaism. Some of these names will be more familiar than others. Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, author of Akedat Yitzchak, then Isaac Abarbanel, who we've learned about previously. Baruch Spinoza talked about Albo's philosophy. Moses Mendelssohn, Christian writers. This is a work that they contended with, whether they agreed, disagreed, whatever. But they all had to contend with this work. Now, I started to bring pieces from the book and then figured I'm not going to make it through. The truth of the matter is, it's 10:52. I could have brought more from the text itself. But I'll tell you some of what he says, and I did bring you some of it here. First of all, he says, if you take a look at source number 16, regarding principles of faith, he says, "It is appropriate to say that every Jew must believe that everything stated in the Torah is wholly true. It's entirely true. Someone who denies a statement which is from the Torah, knowing that it is the Torah's statement, is called a denier." Okay, if you deny it, it's a denier. The term in Hebrew is a kofer, or a kofer, as it's often said. "But someone who holds to Moshe's Torah and believes its fundamentals and then is fooled in his examination when he approaches the Torah by examining the verses and using his own mental faculties such that he says one of the fundamental principles is different, he's not a denier. He's included among the pious sages of the Jews, even though he errs in his examination. He sins accidentally and he must atone for it." This is what he's talking about with the branches. He says, you can be wrong without being a heretic. Not every mistake is heresy. That's the point that he's promoting here. It goes with what we said before. So that's a very important point for him. And he brings up here, since we talked about the Mashiach issue, the Messiah issue, I'll mention it here. I was going to bring it on the sheet and I didn't. I should have. But remember that he said that a Jew who believes that the Messiah already came is not a heretic, he may just be wrong. So he bases himself on a passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin. The last chapter of the Talmud in Sanhedrin, as is printed in our editions, includes a statement from Rabbi Hillel, who says, "Ein Mashiach liYisrael," there is no Messiah for Israel, "Shekvar ba," he already came. So there are all sorts of ways in which that line has been taken and reinterpreted. in order to avoid saying that there was a rabbi who actually said this. Rabbi Hillel, by the way, is not the same as the famous Hillel who, you know, people may be familiar with. They're two different people. This Rabbi Hillel is not the same as the more famous Hillel. But he says, you don't have to rewrite the sentence. You don't need to reinterpret the sentence. He's wrong. And in fact, the follow-up line in the Talmud, the response to Rabbi Hillel is to say, Share le mare, may God forgive him for saying this. Like they disagreed with him. He's wrong. But it doesn't make him a heretic. People can make mistakes without being heretics. That's Rabbi Albo's thesis. He's a big, big believer in prophecy, as we mentioned before. He has a whole discussion about how there are different prophets and they prophesy at different levels. And then the last point that I was going to mention is regarding reward and punishment. I think many of you were there when we did a series in November, I think it was November 2019 at Beth Emeth on life after death. Right? We did a 6-week series and we talked about where you find in the Torah the idea that people survive their death and the ideas of what happens after a person passes away. And we talked about the soul potentially going to some kind of limbo. And we talked about the possibility of reincarnation, right? This rings a bell? Hopefully. Good. So when we talked about Gilgul, as it's termed in Hebrew, when we talked about reincarnation, not the same thing as Tchiyat HaMeitim, the dead coming back to life in this world, but the idea that people come back as somebody else. So you had those who argued, this is not a Jewish idea at all. They said, this is something we got from those outside. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, I think I brought you as one example of somebody who said this was not a Jewish idea. And then you had others who insisted, of course it's a Jewish idea. This is heavily found in the Zohar, central Kabbalistic work, where they talk about not only reincarnation, but how reincarnation works. And the question of, well, if there's, you know, reincarnation, what's happening, and it's different parts of the person's soul, and all of that. So Rabbi Albo deals with the issue of reincarnation. And he says, why not? If God can put the soul into the body once, so what's to stop him then, after the soul has left this body, from putting it into another body? It can come back multiple times. Why not? Why would God be limited in that regard? Thank you, Paul, for your line in the chat. You know, it can certainly happen, but then he goes on and he says, it's unnecessary. He says the point of human existence in this world is for us to use our free will to do what is right and to elevate ourselves. You do that once. You don't need to come back and do it again. That's his argument. So he says it could be, but it's unnecessary. Now, of course, proponents of reincarnation will respond, no, what if you didn't complete what you were supposed to complete here? Right? That's one school of thought in reincarnation. That was Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, the Ari. Or the other school of thought says maybe people need to come back here for punishment. They need to suffer something because they did something wrong the first time. So there is that response. But he says reincarnation could happen, but I don't see that it's necessary as part of the divine project. Okay? Wow, I actually finished within the time. I should have brought more material. I apologize. Questions, comments? I did a lot of pontificating and monologuing here. Yes, Janine.
It's actually about the beginning part of the...
Yeah.
Rabbeinu
Nissim, yeah.
I read through that chapter 11, because my grandson was learning in one of his courses, and I said, oh, I want to read that. And he does mention biblical law, crime would prosper if we needed witnesses, etc. So he does seem to say there's some room for extra religious law to be.
That makes sense. Thank you. It makes sense because his mentor is, you know, not directly because he's born too late, but is the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomi ben Ader, right? He's born, it seems, the year that the Rashba dies. But he's part of that school. So I guess that's something that gets into his thought from, I didn't remember that there, but I guess it's something that he gets from that school. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone. And I hope you'll join us in November for our series on the house that David built. We'll be looking again at Three Kings. And I hope to have fun with that. So,
who do I have to call in order to find out if I registered?
So if you talk to...